Hey everyone, this is Eric Johnson, Flash Gordon from the Sci-Fi TV series, and you're listening to Comic Book Central, where comic books come to life.
Hello fans of Flash and fine four colored adventures everywhere. Welcome to Comic Book Central, where comic books come to life. I'm your host, Joe Stuber. Thanks for joining me here in the lair, where we are continuing to celebrate the legacy of one of the longest-running comic strip and comic book characters of all time, Flash Gordon. If you joined me last week, you got to hear my conversation with the lovely and talented Melody Anderson, who played Flash's love interest Dale Arden in the 1980 film Flash Gordon. This week, an entirely different take on the character of Flash Gordon. On this episode of Comic Book Central, I'm going to focus on the 2007 Sci-Fi Channel television series. And I'm going to be sitting down with the star of that series, Flash himself, Eric Johnson. And Flash isn't the only comic book cred Eric has. You'll hear more about that in just a few minutes. But first, I want to welcome in all the new listeners to Comic Book Central. Whether you found the show through Twitter, Facebook, the iTunes Essentials podcasts, which it is now part of, through shows like the IndieCast or Monster Kid Radio, others who have shared it on their blog and on their websites, welcome one and all. I appreciate you checking out the show. I think you're going to want to stick around because it has been a very busy few weeks here at the Lair. A lot of guests making reservations, a lot of recording going on. Many, many cool episodes are coming up. You don't want to miss a second of the fun. Speaking of fun podcasts, be sure to check out Monster Kid Radio, where Derek Cook and I just wrapped up our look at the horror comedies of Abbott and Costello. That's right, both parts of our chat are online at monsterkidradio.net. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes, and while you're there, if you haven't already, be sure to subscribe to Comic Book Central as well. So check out those episodes on Monster Kid Radio, subscribe to the show, subscribe to Comic Book Central. Please be so kind when you're in iTunes to leave a review. If you like what you're hearing from all these amazing guests that are stopping by, the ones that are going to be coming up as well when you hear those, leave a review. I really appreciate that. You can also follow the show on Twitter at ComicBookCTRL. Like and share The Lair on Facebook at facebook.com/ComicBookCentralNetwork. Drop me a line, joe@comicbookcentral.net. Would love to hear from everybody. You can also, on the website, click the Signal Me tab at comicbookcentral.net. I love hearing from all of you listeners. You've got some great input. Keep it coming. All right, back to the show. Flash Gordon. It was 1934. In 2014, the character was 80 years old. He is still going strong. A new movie, possible. It's rumored to be headed into production. We've got a ton of animated series, comic books, the 1980 film, and yes, it is available on DVD, the entire 2007 series, Flash Gordon, starring my guest today, Eric Johnson. Born in Edmonton, Alberta, Canada, Eric got his start in acting at a very early age. And as a teen, he landed the memorable role as a younger version of Brad Pitt's character Tristan in Legends of the Fall, was also starring legendary actor Anthony Hopkins. In 2001, Eric became part of the Superman mythology when he was cast as star quarterback for the Smallville Crows, Whitney Fordman, opposite Tom Welling's Clark Kent on Smallville. Whitney was Clark's chief rival for the affections of the lovely Lana Lang, but he didn't make it past the first season. Well, hey, Clark and Lana did have to fall in love, right? All right, that said, spoiler alert, his character was given a fitting send-off, a heroic death, as we found out in season 2 of the show. Eric continued that heroic streak when he was cast as the lead in the 2007 Sci-Fi Channel series Flash Gordon. The series was loosely based on Alex Raymond's classic comic strip, and while the characters Dale, Ming, Dr. Zarkov, and the planet Mongo were all there, this Flash was decidedly more down-to-earth. And unfortunately, so were the ratings. Flash was canceled after only one season, but the untapped potential is certainly there when you watch it. Head to Amazon, pick up the entire series for less than $9, and judge for yourself. There are some really cool things happening on Mongo. Well, my guest today hazed young Clark Kent on the first season of Smallville before becoming a hero in his own right. by bringing Alex Raymond's creation Flash Gordon to life on television. He is currently starring in the hit Cinemax series The Nick. I want to welcome to the show Eric Johnson. Eric, welcome to Comic Book Central.
Thanks so much for having me.
I appreciate you being here. You started acting when you were 9 years old, is that correct?
Yeah, I started in, just like theater classes and where I grew up in Edmonton and had a blast. And it was shortly after that I started doing professional theater with the theater company I was taking the classes with. And so I was 11 on stage in front of, 750 people, doing eight shows a week and pretty much fell in love with it. And just really couldn't think of anything better to do with my time. And I couldn't think of anything else that could take the 10 and get paid for it. So it seemed like the best job in the world to me.
How does a 9-year-old kid in Canada get into the acting profession? How does this come about? I was reading comic books at 9 years old. I was sitting around watching Electric Company at that time.
Well, I think I was taking classes, and then through the people that ran the classes, they had their own professional theater company, and they would do three shows a year, and it was family theater stuff, stuff that shows like The Secret Garden and Charlotte's Web and things like that, and so I auditioned for the role and got it, and
had you seen something? Like, had you seen a play? Did your parents see something, or like what triggered like, oh, that there's something different, like I'm playing cowboys over here, but then, oh, there's this other thing.
Well, it's kind of strange. Whenever the school would do a play or there'd be a performance or something like that, I was always, front of the line, wanted to do it. My parents said that, I came out before I could talk, I was already performing at the dinner table. And then there was a girl in our neighborhood who was a teenager, and she took like a 2-week summer course and they thought that since I was a little theatrical and probably quite annoying to be around, that it would suit me. And my mom was up for anything that would get me out of the house for 2 weeks in the summer.
There was a girl involved. Is this what you're saying?
No. Well, she's much older. She was, she was like 16 and I was 9 years old. She lived in the neighborhood and, the mom's got stalking and, so they sent me, and I was eagerly signed up, and it was just a 2-week summer course, and then they offered a year long thing, and I signed up, and of course just hated it because it was work, and I had to do homework for that as well.
Okay, what's acting homework? What is that?
Well, memorizing monologues and that kind of thing, has to do assignments of what's your character's motivation and breaking it down beat by beat and
at
what
nine.
Do you mean with this part of yeah, exactly. So but we'd get to the year end performance and we'd do our thing for the adults and then I'd be hooked and want to sign up again for the next year. And I did that for 5 years and wow. Did a couple of professional shows with them and there was a small TV and film community in Edmonton, and I was very fortunate to land some early work. And it was like I said, I couldn't think of anything else that I'd be good at, and that I could get away with just running around and playing pretend.
Well, that seems to be a common theme with some of the interviews we've done here. Just like that's this is what I wanted to do. This is what I was good at. So. You just kind of ran with it.
To flash forward to Flash Gordon,
no pun intended.
You think about, you're a kid, you're running around with a ray gun, fighting aliens and robots and going through wormholes, and then actually being an adult and getting to run around and do that with the coolest toys and have a bunch of people that are all playing with you. And it's pretty much just like being a big kid and getting away with it.
That's the trick. You figured out how to get paid for it. I never figured that part out. I just ran around with a ray gun. I still do it. I still run around the house with a ray gun. Who were your influences growing up? What TV shows, movies, what kind of things impact? Obviously acting. So did you see different movies and you're like, I want to do that.
Well, actually the first live action movie that I owned was actually Tim Burton's Batman.
Wow. And nice. 25th anniversary, too.
Yeah, I watched that over and over and over and over again. Pretty much had the whole thing memorized. And, you know, so I watched that. And I'd watched, you know, Disney films and all that. But that was the first live-action film that really hooked me. You know, I thought that movie was absolutely the best and, you know, wanted to be Batman. But then, you know, like another movie that really, really, impacted me was, Dances with Wolves. I saw that in, you know, my parents weren't movie buffs. We didn't go to the theater. We didn't really rent a lot of movies. It wasn't something that we did. So like they were, it was a big event. And, I think all the press had started to come out, like this is November and there was the Oscar buzz around Dances with Wolves, why it's important. And my grandmother and my aunt took my brother and myself and my mom. And so watching Dances with Wolves on the big screen, I'd never seen anything like that. And it absolutely blew my mind. So, I realized at that point, I'm like, I want to be the guy that does that. Because it was amazing. It was just absolutely mind blowing to me at 13 years old. It really, really set a huge mark in terms of my cinematic taste moving forward.
Okay, put us in the timeline here then. Pretty early on, you played a young Brad Pitt in Legends of the Fall, correct?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, yeah, so where was this? After, where did that fall in?
That's a year after a year after seeing Dances with Wolves.
You saw that movie and said, I want to do that. And next thing you know, you're playing the Brad Pitt role.
Yeah. Wow. Running around with a grizzly bear. Yeah. Yeah.
That's huge.
Yeah. It was amazing too, because up until that point, you know, Hollywood, you know, felt very far away. I was 11, I think I was 11 or 12 and I auditioned to play Clint Eastwood's son in the movie Unforgiven, because they shot that about 3.5 hours south of where I lived. Oh, wow. And it was sort of an open casting call to find his son. And I didn't get the job, but it was, you know, it was the first time that I had auditioned for something. And then like a year later, 2 years later, a year and a half later, I watched the Oscars and it wins Best Picture. And I'm like, it was right there in my backyard. And I'm
so
like, that it doesn't feel so far away. And then, the year after that, Legends of the Fall comes up, and it's it's got Anthony Hopkins and Aidan Quinn, and there it is. It's a Hollywood film right there in my backyard, and I get to be in it and really run around the woods for 2.5 weeks with a grizzly bear, and it's a dream job when you're 14 years old.
It doesn't get much
and
bigger.
And then again, yeah. It comes out and, you know, Brad Pitt's star factor goes through the roof and everybody knows the movie. So many people have seen it. And, you know, I got a phone call at like 6 a.m. from a radio station in Texas wanting to do a morning show interview. it was bizarre. This is the weirdest thing. I'm asleep. It's before 7 a.m. It's like 6:30.
They called you then to do the interview then? They weren't setting it up.
Yeah.
Like, can you go live, like, right now?
Yeah, basically. And, it's 6:30 in the morning. My mom comes down. I hear the phone ring. Like, who's calling? My mom comes in. She wakes me up. She goes, Eric, the phone's for you. I'm like, what? Who is it? And she goes, it's Tom Brokaw. I'm like, this is the weirdest dream I'm having.
Wow.
And I have no idea. So I go and I pick up the phone and it's Tom Brokaw on the other end. And he just says, in his very Tom Brokaw voice.
Yeah, well, can you do a Tom Brokaw, everybody?
He just says, there's Tom Brokaw. And just wanted to let you know, I saw the film. And it was very good. And, we're friends with the Pitt family. We've known them for a while. Just wanted to extend my congratulations to you.
Wow. Nice Tom Brokaw, by the way.
Or 15. And it's incredibly surreal.
Oh.
And it was very odd. So it took this distant idea of what Hollywood was, and it and it made it very tangible and it made it very close. And I realized that there was nothing preventing me from achieving the things that I wanted to do, or there was no barrier unless I created one.
Yeah.
And that I realized at that point there was no way I wanted to do anything else with the rest of my life. I mean, this is the world I wanted to play in.
Well, it takes it from that big screen image to in your living room. I mean, that's amazing. What an introduction into Hollywood. What did you learn?
Yeah.
What did you learn about show business on Legends of the Fall that made you want to stick with acting? I mean, you talked about some of the heavyweights that were in this. What sort of lessons did you pick up, even at just such a young age?
You know, there was an actor on that show who, and it's sad because I don't think he ever knew, but he had a tremendous impact on me in terms of what being a professional meant. And his name was Gordon Tootoosis. And we had a lot of our scenes together, and he was just such a professional and just such a wonderful, gracious human being, and funny and prepared and just always. And you know, I saw how the crew respected him tremendously, and he just had this incredible presence, and was able to put me at ease, because, you know, I'm also pretty nervous. And
well, you're young,
and yeah, you know, and he had a tremendous influence. I know it was only like 2.5 weeks, but he left a definite impact on me in terms of how I wanted to carry myself on set, the kind of person I wanted to be. And you know, the crew did as well. And, you know, my mom was there with me, and it was so weird to her. And she hated it. She was bored out of her mind. Right. And I'm eyes wide open all day thinking this is the greatest thing in the world.
This is not a stage. It's not a stage mom, right? She's not.
No, not at all. I don't,
this isn't like Honey Boo Boo.
Yeah, she hasn't been on a set since then. Like,
wow.
She's just like no interest. Like,
that's good parenting, that's right, totally there. Fine. That's good parenting,
yeah,
right there.
And you know, we were going home at the end of the night, and there was the PAs are wrapping up the garbage, and I was just going, wow, that was a long day, because it was like a 13-hour day or something like that. And she goes, yeah, and you see that? Those people are still working, and they were here before you when you got here. So, and it was just that perspective of there's people there before me, there's people there after me. None of us, we can't do this without the entire team. You're just a member of the team. You're doing your specific job, and you're very lucky because it's one that you get a lot of attention for, but you're only one part of the team, and you need all these other people to be able to do what you want to do.
Oh, good for mom. Good for mom for bringing
it
home.
And so that experience, which I think could have been very, you know, with different people surrounding you, could have steered me down a sort of different path as a young actor, and in terms of ego and confidence and self-importance. And I think I was very lucky that my friends didn't care, and that, you know, my mom had her head on her shoulders, and that there was people like Gordon Tootoosis who were just such a shining example of the kind of pro that I wanted to be. So yeah, it was definitely a formidable time, and again, I think back, it's 2.5 weeks, man. It was it sounds so ridiculous, but
there's your crash course. There's the acting class that you needed. That was the that was the homework that you needed to be doing.
Yeah. Exactly.
Wow, that's amazing.
It was a fun ride.
That's amazing. Well, now you mentioned in a previous interview that you were not a comic book reader until Smallville. You portrayed the captain of the football team on that show. Were you a jock? So you weren't a comic book reader. Okay.
No.
So no comic books. No jock.
Look,
where
I'm
did
a
you
theater,
fall? Theater geek.
Yeah, I was an idiot. I was running around.
Okay, so you're in the nerd zone. It's just a different type of nerd.
Yeah, the thing is, I didn't have comic books. My brother didn't collect comic books. He was the hockey player, sports guy. And, you know, to be honest, there wasn't a lot of, there was the kids in my neighborhood weren't into it. There was one kid and we hung out, and he only lived in the neighborhood for like a year and a half, but he was into comic books and he was an amazing, artist at a young age. Like he could just teach and he drew comic book characters all the time. And he collected Marvel cards, and so I started collecting Marvel cards for a period of time, and he moved away, and that was the end of that. But, yeah, my first real foray into comic books and even owning comic books wasn't until Smallville.
Wow. Do you kind of, like, wish you had that background? Because, like, now everything's comic books. Like, every TV show, every movie that's being done is all comic books, and all of us comic book nerds are like, yeah! So, like, did you look at this now and go, oh, boy, I got to go back and review all these things.
I love things like, you know, I have a few graphic novels and I'm pretty selective with that. And, you know, I flip two friends' comic books and stuff. But at the same time, I love the genre. Like, my first live-action film that I owned was Batman. And...
Yeah. So, okay, so you had some cred. You had some nerd cred going in, so I'll give you that.
You know, it's you know, I love those type of epic stories. So it was, you know, I just didn't have it on paper.
How did you first find out about the role of Whitney Fordman for Smallville?
Well, what's interesting is that, you know, I'd spent pilot seasons in L.A. the 2 years previous, and had auditioned for Roswell. And it was so funny because I didn't get it, obviously. But I remember I came into that same casting director's office the next year, and she just started apologizing to me. And it was a very weird experience. She goes, Eric, I'm so sorry that I didn't bring you into test for Roswell. And I thought it was very strange. And then the next year, it was Dark Angel, and, David Nutter, had directed both of those pilots. And I ended up, going in for a role on Dark Angel and didn't get it. But David Nutter knew me but the first role I read for on Smallville was, Clark Kent. And had sent in tape and then met with, David Nutter in Vancouver. And, you know, it was kind of obvious to me that it wasn't a fit, but I appreciated David Nutter being a fan.
Well, you're blonde.
The first goal that I sent, out was Lex Luthor.
Then that's not a problem.
was so not right for me. And
right,
then,
but it doesn't matter whether you're blonde or not.
Yeah, and then it was Clark Kent, and they flew me out to Vancouver to meet with David, and which was very cool. And this is me being kind of bummed out, but they go, well, we want you to send tape. As Whitney Fordman. We want you to come down to LA and audition as Whitney Fordman. And I said, no. I said, because I'm like, you guys have seen like three different tapes of me, and I can't, and that, wow. The real reason is
that's the exact story Michael Rosenbaum told.
Really?
Yeah, he said they wanted more tapings. Like, you, I can't do it better than that. You got enough. That's amazing.
You got enough. That's it.
Wow.
And the reason I said no is I'm like, I couldn't afford a last minute flight to LA.
Yeah.
And so I said, you know, if you want me, you got to fly me down. And, you know, I'm living in Edmonton at the time and in my parents' basement. and I just said, no, you know, I don't want to be yanked around here. And to their credit, and probably and a huge thanks to David Nutter, I'm sure. They brought me down and to screen test me for Whitney Fordman, and it just felt like the right fit. And And it hasn't happened often, but there was a moment where there's that moment where, you know, the screen test is over and I kind of just knew.
Yeah.
I just knew that from that moment on, I was going to have a small footnote in the saga of Superman and its history.
Well, that role fit you like a glove. I mean, it's perfect. Well, I mean, you're basically playing not really the nemesis of Clark, but more like the rival for his mm-hmm. affections for Lana. I don't get that it's – I mean, it is an adversarial role, but I get the sense that early on it's like you don't really want to pick on him. You're just kind of like you're the captain of the football team. You're the jock. So mm-hmm. you haze him, and it's in the cornfield, the iconic shot. When you first got the role, how did you see this fitting in, the series fitting into the Superman mythology? It's completely different.
Well, you know, for me, it was, I knew, first of all, it was, you know, fascinating. You know, the fact that they were going to take this origin story and delve into these years. I'm like, this is perfect. This is what a great television show. I knew right from the get-go that this was something that was going to go a long time. Like, especially, you know, if everybody was delivering on what they were promising in the pilot, like, this is a great show. It had the story engine of the Freak of the Week. It had this incredible built-in audience. An epic origin story where you know where he ends up. And so it's just a matter of filling in the blanks and how he got there. So I thought it was, I knew it was brilliant. I knew it was going to go. I didn't know it was going to go 10 years, which is incredible.
It's a long run.
I don't think anybody would have put their money down on that, but, it was definitely special. I mean, you could feel it, and then even when it came out and the response and how people gravitated to it, and it was something very new, I think. And you know, there had been Lois and Clark before, and which was a little different. You know, this had that great sort of teen angst quality to it, and the rule was, you know, no flights, no tights kind of thing, and. So I don't know. I loved it. I thought it was fantastic, and I thought it was a really great addition to the Superman world.
Yeah, everything's right there in the pilot. I mean, you watch that, and mm-hmm. you get the series, you get the next 10 years right there, which is very rare, like you said. Were you a Superman fan?
I was not a Superman fan, and this is a battle between my wife and I. She's very much a Superman fan, and as I told you.
See,
I'm
I don't get
fan.
This. I don't look. I love that you're a Batman fan. So, I'm from near the Pittsburgh area. So I love Michael Keaton. I love that was your introduction to the comic book world. But my goodness, Superman. That's it. Like, I'm with your wife on this.
Yeah, I mean, Superman's okay.
He's got everything given. He's got all the stuff. Yeah, he's super.
He's got all the toys.
Mm-hmm.
And really even Alien. So,
yes.
You know.
I'll give you that. That's fair enough.
That's my whole thing. He's an alien. He's a better human than all of us.
Yes.
Awesome.
Like, had you seen the Christopher Reeve movies? You mentioned Lois and Clark. I mean, like, so you were around it. Like, had you seen those?
Yeah. I'd seen the Christopher Reeve movies on TV. Here's a little addition to what was going on when I was 14. I also did a movie of the week for CBS called Black Fox, which was starring Christopher Reeve. And so pretty much at the same time, they had to do a reshoot for that while I was shooting Legends of the Fall. And they had to work around the schedule of Legends of the Fall. And so I show up, and it's for one line, and it's me and Christopher Reeve. And and the line was, I had to yell at him. So I'm like, I'm yelling at Superman. This is kind of cool. And I said, are you fellas coming or waiting for a Comanche haircut? And it was hilarious. It was one line. It was one line in this movie of the week. And they had to bring me back in for a reshoot for one day and work around the schedule. And he says, kid, you're pretty popular these days. I said, yeah. He says, we had to work really hard to get you in here. So, good for you, kid. And, so that was pretty amazing to, have a little chat with.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah,
that's
classic. That was a big moment.
Not too many actors get that moment. What was the shooting schedule like on Smallville? I mean, you're shooting up in Canada, so you're in your backyard almost.
Yeah, I mean, I moved to Vancouver permanently. I lived in Vancouver at times before that, just, for a few months at a time. But, I moved there, and I think the pilot we shot over, it was like 20-day shoot or something like that. Or 24, it was crazy.
That seems a lot for a pilot, doesn't it?
That's insane. And so, I was in Vancouver for 5 or 6 weeks while we did the pilot. And then we jumped into series, and I think it was 8 days with 2 days of second unit. But, I mean, the beginning of the show, it was a mess. Like, we were into, I think, our fifth episode, and we hadn't completed one yet. Like, we were still owning shots on and still picking up a few shots from the pilot that were reshot, and there was a character that was recast, and so it was a bit of a cluster to get it off the ground. But obviously that show became a machine after that, and it was just a bit of a rocky start, but... for me, I mean, I worked 1 or 2 days an episode. It wasn't a big deal to me. But poor Tom, the guy, I don't think he got any sleep that first year. He was just, he was, every day was 15 hours, I'm sure, for him.
It didn't seem like he got much sleep through the entire run. I mean, he's in almost every shot.
No. Yeah.
That's unbelievable.
It's kind of the thing when the show's about you and you're Superman.
Did you get to talk to him about the project itself, like get his thoughts on... how he saw the Superman mythology, or what he thought of the whole process?
I don't think so. I don't think we ever sat down formally before we started. And
you're a method actor.
we were all pretty much just, kids really. And, it was his first big role. And I think there was a lot of nerves of getting going, and, Kristen was 18 years old, I had just turned 22 when the series, when we started shooting the series. So it was, we're all a bunch of kids then, with a job, and we were all pretty excited. The grizzled veteran was Rosenbaum. I think he was 27 years old.
Wow. Yeah. That's amazing. You were in the first season. Obviously, we got to get to Clark and Lana, so you can only be a rival for his affection, for her affections, for so long. Yeah. Do you have a favorite episode of either of the ones you were in, or did you watch the series after you left?
There was a couple afterwards. I'm trying to remember exactly what they were. My personal favorite was the last one I did. Actually, I had such a blast.
You got a great out.
Yeah. I mean, that whole sequence, at one point we had 7 cameras rolling because it was such a big sequence.
Wow.
We had helicopters and explosions in the water and the, big practical effects and, going out as a hero. And, that was an awesome day. It was just an awesome day. I had a blast. It was this big, epic sequence, and so I had a blast. There was a bunch of great moments. Even in the second episode of Metamorphosis, when my truck gets attacked and it starts rolling, there was this moment where they strapped me into this truck. They turned it on its roof. They attached a tow cable to it. Put a camera in there with me, and then started dragging it down the road. And my head is, 6 inches from the concrete as it's getting dragged down the road. And I have to pretend I'm unconscious, and I'm like, this is the craziest job in the world. This is amazing. This is right after I watched them air ram this truck as it did like 6 flips and ended up in the ditch. And it was just awesome. It was just an awesome you know, we got to do fun stuff like that. It was great. You know,
yeah, they had a little bit of a budget on this one too.
Yeah, having a fight with wire work with in a graveyard. It was
a female protagonist, didn't she like take possession of you at some point? And
absolutely. Absolutely. And you can see her on starring in Masters of Sex now. So we did two episodes with her and it was great.
Yeah, it's a very cool series. And you have a very personal connection to the show, correct?
Of Smallville?
Yes.
You mean
one that has carried on well beyond the series? Yeah.
That is indeed. That is where I met my wife, and she was working on the show as a cast assistant to Annette O'Toole, and I met her, and we had a very quiet romance where nobody really knew about it at first, and then we moved in together at when the season ended, and it's been 13 years, so. Something worked out real well for me.
Yeah, you got a family out of this.
I certainly did.
Yeah,
I certainly did.
Well, and let's bring it up to from the rival to the hero himself, Flash Gordon. 2014 is the 80th anniversary of Flash Gordon. Did you ever think that you would be portraying a character that had this much backstory? This much history.
I mean, he's kind of the original.
Yeah.
You know,
he's years older than Superman. Is it 5 years older?
Yeah.
6 years older?
You know, it's such an interesting property too. The different incarnations of it and some of the early stuff were the comics were like nonsensical at times. It's such an interesting property and the variations that it's had. And, you know, I think it was probably the most popular with its serials in the 50s. And, but it's, the thing I loved about him is that I felt that there was an aspect, and I think we were able to do it a couple of times where we were really able to tap into it in the show where there's this almost like an Indiana Jones element, you know, where he's just a regular guy who's overmatched and out-muscled, and the only thing that's going to get him through things is quick thinking and the help of his friends. And I think when we did that with the show, those were the real fun moments. But yeah, it was wild. It was wild stepping into the hero shoes. I play a lot of bad guys.
Yes, so you do.
It was a nice
even not necessarily bad guys, but maybe smarmy guys.
Yeah. Yeah. I play a lot of people don't like.
Just that way. Well, this was the hero. You mentioned a few things. How much of the character's history did you know when you got the role? Because you mentioned the serials from the 30s, the TV series from the 50s. There's a ton of animated series. Obviously, the movie from 1980. How could we forget Flash?
Yeah, I hadn't seen the movie. But, you know, the great thing is that the internet gives you everything.
Yes.
And so I was able to go through and I bought a stack of comics. I went and raided the Vancouver comic book stores and emptied them out of Flash Gordon stuff. It was pretty cool. It was pretty cool getting back into it. And again, there's the different incarnations of it, but you know, there was there was always Dale Arden, there was always Princess Aurora, there was always Ming the Merciless, and it was funny. I think there was a show that the network wanted to do. There was a show that the creators wanted to do. And I think there was some conflict there early on. And in terms of what the network wanted to see on TV every week and what Peter Hume wanted to do.
This is the show creator, Peter Hume.
Yeah. And it was tough. I think there was, shows can, some shows take longer than others to find their way, and I think the problem was that there was a bit of a misstep early on of the people who were Flash Gordon fans going, well, this isn't Flash Gordon, what is this? Mm. And we totally agreed. Like, we knew. We knew going in that this, this isn't, totally true to any source material. And I think as we started moving forward, and I guess as the rats were jumping off the sinking ship, we were allowed to see more of what we wanted to do, and the reins were sort of pulled off as they, had already, their ideas of cancellation or not had crossed their heads, and nobody wanted to be the last one on the ship. But, I think where we left off in the season, it where we were able to leave off was where I think the show wanted to go, where the show maybe could have gone from the get-go.
That's what I wanted to ask you about, because you mentioned show creator Peter Hume. How was the show pitched to you? Because it seems to me when you watch the show, you get a sense that this is a slow build to a universe-spanning story. Is that how it was pitched to you initially?
Yeah, I think it was we joked, and I think one of the things was, Flash gets by with the help of his friends, and I think we always knew that the idea of the our version of Freak of the Week coming through a porthole, sending them back through the porthole, was not a story engine that was really true to Flash Gordon. But it's that type of success on other shows, I think, really drove the network to require that, to want that. And that's not a bad idea. I mean, you Smallville is based on that kind of idea. You have the Freak of the Week, and Eureka, which was a huge show for them, had that element. And
For viewers that haven't seen it, basically what it is you're on Earth with your friend, yeah, with Dale and Hans Arkoff, and there are these riffs. It kind of reminded me of Fringe a little bit, where there are these kind of riffs, these little holes in space,
yeah,
where you can cross over between worlds.
Or sliders, remember that show?
Yeah, exactly, with John Rhys Davies, yeah.
Yeah, so it was, a little bit like that. It was interesting. I think there was a lot of figuring it out as we went in terms of what we could do. And also we were pretty limited in our budget in terms of the scope in which we could achieve. And, our visual effects at times were, it took a while to get those exterior shots on Mongo, lit and built properly, but we're,
you've got like this red hue, like there's a definite look that you're pulling off with it.
Yeah, but I mean, again, the thing is that all those things aside, all those battles that happened well behind closed doors that I really wasn't aware of and wasn't privy to until small conversations afterwards. We just went out and tried to have as much fun as possible. We knew that we didn't have enough time to shoot our show. We knew we didn't have enough money to shoot our show. And so we were going to have a great time doing it. And I think despite all those stresses and then, seeing the numbers coming back and them not being very good, we were able to maintain that, that positive environment in some challenging conditions for pretty much the whole 9.5 month run.
Do you think stories like Flash Gordon and Buck Rogers and these, like, they were created in the 30s, so it's like, hey, mm-hmm, let's go from Earth to space, and it's cool, and we can do this. Do you think that's tougher to pull off now, just because it's like, look, we know it's like a space shuttle takes forever to get up, and they scrubbed that, that a few years ago, and, it's like space travel from Earth, we're not buying it. Do you think it's tough to pull off a show like that, and how do you do it?
I think it is hard. I think it's hard in a lot of ways of our suspension of disbelief. We know so much more. It's easier to believe these things if it's a fantastical environment completely. It's harder to believe these things when you're basing it in, real world physics and real people. Again, like, we know how long it takes a space shuttle to get somewhere. And we know that if we get to another planet, chances are we're going to have to wear our helmets and wear a protective suit. And maybe the gravity's too strong, or maybe it's not strong enough. And the days of being able to go to another world on Star Trek and run into people who speak English and walk around with our helmets off are, you know, I think we're kind of done. I don't think we can do those anymore. And, you know, even things as iconic as Star Trek, it probably peaked with the Next Generation and the other versions that came after that. Even the numbers, I think, get smaller as the audience is educated. It's harder to maintain that suspension of disbelief. And again, like you said, those were created in the 30s, where a guy could build a rocket ship in his garage and go to a faraway planet.
Right.
So, we have that on one hand, and we have Interstellar on the other.
Yeah, it's kind of tough. I mean, how do you do a contemporary version of a guy from Earth that just goes to Planet Mongo? You know, it becomes different. I'm guessing that's what Peter Hume was trying to figure out. Like, about halfway into the season, you get that. Like, there's more Mongo. There's more Ming.
Yeah.
More of the creatures. I mean, you've got the version of the Hawkmen. You've got, like, the Lionmen. You've got these ice creatures and different things. Was that, like, what were your talks, your conversations with Peter Hume about during this time? Was like, okay, let's amp up the Mongo or something.
Well, I think, you know, he wanted to get the show to Mongo as fast as possible. I mean, he wanted to get it there and that's because that's where the fun of the show is. You know, that's where the adventure is. That's where the kind of the silliness is. And I mean, really, so much of this was a costume drama. And, you know, you could go to these different places and I'd end up dressed up as somebody else, pretending to be something that I'm not.
Or not dressed up, as the case may be.
Exactly. You know, it's kind of hilarious. And so our wardrobe department was amazing in terms of what they were creating, and our set designers, production designers, what they were being able to turn out and build in very short periods of time was incredible. But we got to Mongo, and it's like, you know, I know Peter wanted to go to Mongo because that's where all the fun is. You know, that's where you can go and you can see the Bogmen and like you said, the Lionmen and the Hawkmen and all that kind of fun stuff, which is the stuff that, you know, people from that watched or knew the comics or knew the source material, that's the stuff they wanted to see.
Oh, the back half of the season is really fun. I mean, when you watch it, I mean, it's not that the first part isn't fun, but like, again, it's that slow build. We see that with S.H.I.E.L.D. It's the slow build, and then it's like, oh, boom, here we go. And it's like, give it time. So, yeah, unfortunately, sci-fi.
I think if memory serves me correctly, I think it started about episode 9. And then I think we were pretty much running out of money and had to do a clip show, like a partial clip show around episode 12. And then, and then the writer's strike happened.
Oh.
And the writers on our show, they did an incredible job. Is they basically pumped out, I think it was 5 or 6 scripts in maybe more, and to get it to have them done.
To get it done before the strike.
The writer's strike.
Wow.
Yeah, and so they worked their butts off to give us enough material for a season. Because it was looming, and we're like, we're going to be stuck. We're not going to be able to do anything. And and they worked their butts off, got in something before the writer's strike, and we were able to finish our season.
But well, you guys amped it up in the back half. I mean, it shows. What's the best part about becoming Flash Gordon?
You know what? I think I touched on it earlier. It's you get to run around and play pretend with ray guns and silly costumes and throw karate chops and paddle. You know,
and hang out with Gina Holden.
Yes, and just, you know, and Jody Rafico, who is hilarious, and I mean, it was really just fun. And I mean,
not
I think
since
I was
the days of Shazam has a Winnebago ever taken such a central role in a show. I love that thing.
Yeah, that thing was awesome. Here's a little side story. Jody's probably going to kill me for telling you this, but he lived on an island outside of Vancouver. And so he'd come in for days of shooting, but he had his own like mini camper truck that he'd stay in at the studio. So he'd drive there and stay in his camper truck and while we shot, and then go back to Bowen Island. So he was a little Dr. Zarkov as it was.
He had a Winnebago.
Yeah, oh, it's quite funny. He's a lovely, lovely man, very funny, very talented, and he had the hardest job memorizing all that exposition of made-up words and pseudoscience.
Oh, yeah, I mean, he's got all the dialogue, and yeah, great comic relief, and the chemistry between you and Gina Holden is just amazing, too. It's a very fun ride. I wish we had gotten more of it. Was there a talk of a season two? I know it was canceled, I think, 2 months after the finale. So, like, I think even your last line of the show is, I guess the adventure isn't quite over. And it's like, okay.
Yeah, there was, and there was definite interest. And it was, it came down to a few reasons, but there was definite interest. And I know our parent company, RHI, I think they were talking about going public at that time too. And so there were some things, but I there was a definite interest in, from a lot of the parties, and the show did much better in Europe than it did, in the US. And, it was pretty cool. It was pretty cool. The ad campaign out of the UK was great. And, their prime minister at the time's last name was Gordon. And so they had a lot of fun with this. And it was like my picture in the tube saying, "This Gordon will save every one of us." and it was quite clever and funny and tongue-in-cheek and definitely.
I mean, you knew what that was, right? Because you hadn't seen the movie.
Yes.
But, okay.
Yes. Okay. Yeah. And in fact, TJ Scott, who is one of our directors who came in and did a great job, we were doing this sequence and he'd keep playing the Flash movie soundtrack while we were doing these applied shots of me running. It was hilarious.
Oh.
Absolutely hilarious.
What a great musical background to the company. I mean, that's, you know, you got Queen there too. Favorite episodes, favorite moments with Gina? Anything we can, she's great.
There was a moment we were in the Winnebago and Gina sometime would get the giggles and I'd be able to keep a straight face, but she could tell that I was laughing because my eyes would just get this little bit of a glaze going as we holding in laughter. And we had this scene, I forget what episode it was in, but we had the scene in the Winnebago, and it was Zarkov and Balin and her and me. And for whatever reason, because of the frame, my face had to be really close to hers to make the shot work. And she had to turn and deliver a line to me, and she couldn't do it. She just couldn't do it without bursting out laughing, and she just starts swearing at me and yelling and blaming me. And I'm not doing anything. I'm just there. She's like, "I'm not doing anything," and she's like, "I can see it in your eyes."
It's the potential.
There was no getting out of that scene. We needed to take 5 minutes and just all calm down because that was.
There's a chemistry between the two of you.
Yeah, we had a lot of fun. It was great. I mean, it was because I actually got to be there in casting when we were reading people for that role, and it was fun. It was fun. We had a really good time, and I think we were all pretty tired by the end of it because it was you know, we were shooting 7 day episodes and sometimes 6.5 day episodes. So it was just constantly moving. And, you know, that's about a day and a half short of what we needed. Especially because, you know, we had green screen and fight sequences and practical effects and all those things just take time to set up. But, you know, we got out of there with smiles on our face, I think, for the most part. And, there's episode 16, which is the Bogmen. I'll never forget this, is my daughter was born in the middle of shooting that episode. And the day she was born, we were supposed to shoot the Bogmen sequence. And they said, "You know what? You know, go to the hospital, go deal with that." Well, they knew it was coming, so they'd made arrangements of what they were going to shoot if I wasn't available. And so they pulled out their emergency shoot day and did that instead. And we picked up some, you know, my daughter was born and everybody's happy, healthy, and all that sort of stuff. So a week later, we go back to the forest where we're going to shoot this bog. Now, they had done a really great thing. Is they had made their own bog, and then they'd heated it so that it wouldn't be freezing cold, because we were going to be in there most of the day. And but then they had to turn the heat off because we weren't there for a week. And then they went back and they put the heat in. And the gelatin and peat moss that they had used to create our mud had fermented.
Oh.
And I show up in the location. I'm like, wow, that's a funk. That's a smell. And I'm like,
what an interesting smell you discovered, princess.
And I start, I see them looking at me, and they're like, they're giving me a look. I'm like, why are you looking at me that way? And they're like, okay. And I get to set, and that funk gets worse and worse and worse the closer I get. And the smell is what I've got to go into. And it's just, it was absolutely the foulest thing. It just, it smelled awful. And this is what I got to go in completely face under, head under all the way. And we shot that day, and it was three showers to get that funk off.
Doesn't that get you into character, though?
Oh, totally. I mean, there's
you don't have to worry about acting in that.
No, man, you're 100% committed. There's no way not to be. You know, you're going in. Oh. And so we have fun. Pat Williams, who directed that, we still laugh about that when we catch up nowadays. And it was quite funny.
Did you get a sense that things were wrapping up? Because you the series does have. I mean, you do get it. Doesn't leave you hanging. I mean, it kind of is like here's the adventure that continues. But you do get a nice little wrap up at the end. Did you kind of get a sense that hey, we might not get a season two? We should probably get mom and dad back home.
Yeah, I think for the most part we all wanted it. We all, we were a little family there for a lot part. I mean, I have so much respect for our producers and writers and directors that came in. Again, like I said, I really felt that we were about a day and a half or a day short of the time that we needed, but everybody just pulled up their socks and put their best effort forward. So I think, you know, for me, a second season would have been great. I think we were all hopeful, and I know that they worked hard to try and resurrect it, or not resurrect it, but to keep it going. And it just, you know, you got to remember, like, this is 2007, 2008, and the entertainment world took, the whole economy took a big hit at that time. And Hollywood was cutting back as much as they could, and there was layoffs at a lot of companies and people scaling back. And I think under different economic times, the show would have gone again. I mean, it was a bit of a perfect storm in a lot of ways. I think for myself, I definitely was hopeful, as I felt that where we left off was where the show could have started in a lot of ways. And it was going to be a fun space adventure from then on in.
Yeah, good point about the economy too, because people were pulling back. So hey, you never know. Maybe Peter Hume could finish it off in a comic book. That would be kind of cool to.
Yeah, you never know, right? But I mean, those are the harsh realities that play into. And I know a lot of people. They when shows get canceled or they're not renewed, and as a fan of shows that's happened to, you feel so personally affronted. But there's the hard logistics that go into things too, and it's unfortunate at times that it just doesn't make sense sometimes.
Well, you got 22 episodes. Firefly only got 14, so there's that heartbreak. You got a few extra hours out of it. So
more people come out to the Firefly convention.
You never know. We'd love to see.
Around.
We'd love to see you and Gina out there. at some of these conventions. We got the DVD box set. Go get it. It's a fun ride. Check it out. Hey, latest projects. We mentioned The Nick on Cinemax. Season one done.
Season
two was announced before season one premiered. Correct.
Yeah,
that's got to feel good.
I, that's got to feel really good. It was. It felt really good. It felt, A, great to have a show that get a second season, and not be killed off. So those yes. are two victories. I mean, I don't know if you've had a chance to see it, but it's an incredible show in a lot of ways. It's just a very visceral look at New York in the year 1900 through the eyes of a hospital. And
this is the Knickerbocker Hospital at 1900.
Yeah, it's raw and it's gripping, and Clive Owen is brilliant in it, and Steven Soderbergh directs all 10 episodes as he's going.
Well, you beat me to the punch there. You beat me to the punch. I was going to say there were 10 episodes directed by a certain Peter Andrews. Who is the Steven Soderbergh of whom you mentioned? Who is this guy?
Yeah, you
mentioned that's what's up with that? I thought he was retired.
Well, he retired. It's not a movie; it's a TV show, right?
It's got a feature film feel to it, though, doesn't it?
Yeah. Well, you know, and that's television now, though, too. I mean, if Flash Gordon was getting pitched nowadays, it'd be a much different show.
Yeah,
because I think the procedural element that was demanded of shows in the 2000s just isn't there. People want the serialized nature of things. They want things that stand alone. It's okay to have a show that's going to do 20 episodes and that's it.
Yeah.
You know, and tell that story. It's now long form drama. It's not about whether it can do 100 episodes and reach syndication.
Well, look at Ricky Gervais, or, you know, look at Curb Your Enthusiasm. I mean, these are just like, you know, little short seasons, and get them out there and binge watch
them. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's, you know, there's a certain style of film that we don't see in the cinema anymore because it's those type of stories have gravitated towards television, where in a lot of ways you can tell a deeper, more meaningful story.
Yeah.
And so, you know, that's definitely what the Nick is. It's a world that you could have pulled in a hospital, pulled in a film, but being able to do it over 10 hours instead of two, you just get to cut. You get to cut a lot deeper.
This is, well, no pun intended. This is like basically you're like surgeons at the hospital at like at a time when things just weren't like they are now. Correct?
Yeah. I mean, it takes place on the Lower East Side of Manhattan, and that had the highest population density in the world at that time. And you had people from all over the world moving in, and it was, and they were free, so to speak, right? So it was one of the greatest social experiments in human history, and it was a very hard and rough and at times vile place to be, but it was. It was out of the trials of that time that a lot of some amazing things happened for medicine and society moving forward, of learning how to live with our neighbors in a lot of ways.
You played Dr. Everett Gallinger?
Mm-hmm.
And when can we look for season two?
I've heard rumors that it'll be possibly coming out end of this summer, sort of the same time as we premiered this last year.
Okay.
And of course it's available on Cinemex Go and I think it's not on iTunes yet, but probably soon. Hopefully soon.
Go binge watch 10 episodes of it.
Seriously, it's a binge watching show. And you're going to see some things in there that are I highly recommend to not eat.
Yeah, your character and your wife, and there's a lot going on there.
Yeah,
so, as we go through. So, you've also done a little bit of directing. More of that in your future. Maybe some of the comic book theme shows, Flash, Shield, Arrow.
You never know.
Can you break any news here on Comic Book Central? Have you reached out to anybody? Are you going into the Marvel universe?
Can't break any news for you here, but
all right.
It's definitely something that'll be much more prominent in the future here, and as a big, you know, like I said, watching Dances with Wolves and saying I want to be that guy, and you know, because I saw that, you know, Kevin Costner not only starred it but directed it, that's always been a goal and continues to be become more and more important. So. Hopefully soon. Hopefully soon we can be talking about comic book characters that I've brought to life.
How can we find out more about this? Social media? Are you out there? How can fans find out more about you?
Absolutely. You can. I'm pretty active on Twitter, so you can find me at EricJJohnson79 on Twitter and tell me how much you hated Whitney on Smallville. And
we would never do that. No, he was a hero. Whatever. He ended up being a hero.
Yeah, it's true. It's true.
No, we like that. So yeah, very good. We'll check you out on Twitter. And any appearances you got coming up, I'm sure you're going to put that out there as well too. So, well, you know what? You got to act in the worlds of two of our favorite heroes. We're looking forward to your latest projects as well. And I definitely want to thank you for joining me today on Comic Book Central.
Thanks so much for having me.
For the latest on Eric's series, The Nick, you can check out cinemax.com/the-Nick, K-N-I-C-K. And be sure to follow Eric on Twitter at EricJJohnson79. Once again, my thanks to Eric for joining me today to celebrate the legacy of Flash Gordon. Hey, while you're tweeting it up and following Eric in the Twitterverse, be sure to follow Comic Book Central as well, at ComicBookCTRL, where you can hashtag share the lair. Thank you so much for everyone who has been doing just that. Share Comic Book Central with all your comic-loving friends. Give us a like on Facebook at facebook.com/ComicBookCentralNetwork. And be sure to subscribe to the show in iTunes. Listeners, I want to hear from you. What do you think of today's episode, the Melody Anderson interview? What do you think of Flash Gordon? What's your favorite version? The comic strip, the comic books, the movie, the animated series? There are a bunch of them. The TV series today with Eric. Drop me a line at joe@comicbookcentral.net. Let me know what you think, or you can click the Signal Me tab on the website, comicbookcentral.net. Someone who did just that is listener Jimmy Hayes. Virtual Willie Lumpkin delivered the email to the lair. Jimmy writes, "Great podcast. I've just started listening to Comic Book Central, and it is awesome. I've been meaning to listen for a while, as I'm a regular listener of the IndieCast, and I've been hearing about the show for a while. Love the interviews. I've been going back and listening to the old ones. I love the Melody Anderson episode and the Aaron Gray episode. I'd love to hear Sam Jones, Gil Gerard, and Lee Majors on the podcast someday. Keep up the great work. P.S. If I could ask a small favor, I'm going back and getting all the Indiana Jones comics again, and I'm trying to do it as you review them on the IndieCast. Is there any way you can give a little more advance notice of what you'll be reviewing in the coming weeks? The comic store I work at doesn't carry back issues, really, so I get mine online. And with shipping and that, it takes a while to get them. Thanks." Well, thank you for writing in, Jimmy. Let's take the IndieCast first. Regarding the IndieCast, the world's number one Indiana Jones podcast. It's hosted by Ed Dalista. For those of you who haven't heard that podcast, well, after you listen to this one, be sure you go over, subscribe in iTunes. You'll thank me later. But my buddy Keith Voss and I reviewed all of the Marvel Comics issues. We talked to a bunch of the creative minds behind those books. Now we're going to be moving on to the Dark Horse Comics years. We're going to start our reviews with the Young Indiana Jones Chronicles first. I don't believe that those have been reprinted by Dark Horse Comics, so you're probably going to have to go and pick up each one of those issues separately. Now, after we get through the Young Indiana Jones Chronicles, Keith and I are going to review each of the miniseries chronologically, starting with Indiana Jones and the Fate of Atlantis. The good news is Dark Horse Comics has reprinted all those miniseries in omnibus form. So there's Volume 1 and Volume 2. You can get them on their website, eBay, online retailers. If you're working at a comic book store, you can probably just place an order. Get those in. You'll have all of them right there, so you won't have to pick up all the individual issues. So find them, get them, read them, have fun reading along, listening to the IndieCast. For Comic Book Central, I'm glad you liked the Melody Anderson interview. That was a lot of fun. I really enjoyed that. She was amazing. And thank you for suggesting some of those guests. Those are certainly some folks I would like to hear from as well, I have to say. So let me say this. In fact, even though we're out of time for today's show, I think I've got something you're going to like, Jimmy, and the rest of you listeners as well, because next week on Comic Book Central, I wasn't sure about the timing of all this, folks, so I didn't want to say anything last week,
but we are going to stay in the world of Flash Gordon one more week. On the next episode, the savior of the universe, he saved every one of us, King of the Impossible, the star of the 1980 cult classic film Flash Gordon. Actor Sam Jones will be right here. I hope you will return as well. Until then, get the Flash TV series, get the Flash film, keep reading those comic books. Thanks for joining me here in the Lair, Comic Book Central, where comic books come to life. This podcast is intended for entertainment and education purposes only. All original content of this podcast is the intellectual property of Comic Book Central and is licensed under Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivations 3.0 Unported License. All of the content and names are registered trademarks and copyrights of the respective holders.
My wife, she's a huge Superman fan. She loved, like, the way I watched the Batman movie, she watched Superman movie. She had the whole thing memorized. When she left college, she got an internship at Lois and Clark. That's what she wanted to do, and she made it happen. She is, she ends up working on Smallville, and then, marrying the enemy.
Marrying the enemy. Well, she married Flash Gordon. Come on.